Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Good morning. This is the time and place set in the matter of a special rules hearing. The record may show that due notice was given to the public through the normal channels, including publication of the proposals in the State Bar newsletter, setting this time and place for a public hearing on these proposals. It's the court's custom to invite any comments of opponents first. Thus, if there are no opponents, any proponents obviously can streamline their comments because they're really not rebutting anything. So with that, we will go in order. It's a very informal process, as I call the rule. Number, if you wish to speak, simply come forward to the podium and identify yourself, because we are on the internet, and then just say your piece, and the court may have a few questions. So with that, proposal number one is a proposed adoption of a new rule in regards to defining the key components for drug courts in the state of South Dakota. Are there any opponents to rule number one? Okay, are there any proponents? Very well. Rule proposal number two, an adoption of a new rule in regards to governing evidence-based probation supervision practices. Are there any opponents? Are there any proponents? All right, number three, a proposed adoption of a new rule in regards to establishing earned discharge policy for certain probationers. Any opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good morning.
And other justices of the court, Ryan Kobeck here with the South Dakota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Specifically with Section 3, I filed objections and a proposed amendment to this section. And it has to do with the definitions regarding specifically subsection C within the definition of a probation violation. The probation violation in this proposed rule is defined as a written report by the probation officer, and basically equates both the probation violation report with a probation violation, meaning it's the same thing. My amendment is specifically just to add in a different section here where the language that I use, the title of subsection C, would be a probation violation report, and that would be the written request or the report by the probation violation, or I'm sorry, by the probation officer who would be filing it and would be reviewed. And then a probation violation is only a finding by either a judge, which I'll be discussing later with the sanction grid, or else basically an agreement between the probationer and the probation officer that there was a violation. So the main reason being that the same person who alleges the violation should not be the one who finds the violation.
Help me. It's been a little bit of time since I've checked specific statutes, but my recollection is that under statute, the probation officers currently have the authority to incarcerate for up to 48 hours. Assuming my memory is correct, is that consistent with your proposal?
Yes. I believe that they could still hold, and I believe in the sanction grid, which is in a different rule, that if the person is deemed to be a danger, they can hold them with a violation report. And I don't even know for sure if 48 hours, to be honest with the court, is needed. I don't think a Gerstein hearing is required for a probation violation.
No, I'm saying my understanding was that you could incarcerate on an order of a CSO for up to 48 hours. But I don't have the code with me, maybe my memory's...
And I believe that could be done just with the filing of the report, and that person could be held.
Okay.
I can tell you right now that with my review of this, and I appreciate the effort that's done by everybody, and I'm not here to critique, I just think that we do need to have some kind of standardization. There's a person right now within Minnehaha County Jail. The probation violation, I don't even know if there's a report filed, and I'll be honest with you with that, because a person was arrested and it's on October 27th. which is last Sunday. They've been inside the Minnehaha County Jail. Mark Cady, who's a defense attorney on the case, has been trying to figure out why this person's been arrested. And I get the background. He's a probationer. He's on probation for forgery. And he was arrested for disorderly conduct. And he was on October 27th. He is still in the Minnehaha County Jail this morning. I checked before I came. There has been no report actually filed. The state's attorney, Don Hansen, has no knowledge about what's going on. And this person has been in for now 8 days. So they can hold. And in Pennington County, I heard that sometimes they can hold for even longer until the judge's a hearing is held, and sometimes the probation violation is lifted. But with regards to just the definitions, they can hold with a report, and I think the rules allow you to do so if the person is determined to be a danger and the person is going to be a problem for society. But then, as far as the definition goes, the actual violation should not be found until later.
So. Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay, any other opponents before Mr. Satizan streaks to the podium to rebut? Drupal, you can have a seat. I mean, you have to stand up to the whole hearing. Mr. Satizan, you seem to want to speak.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll just very briefly, the entire concept of earned discharge is really intended to start peeling back caseloads. As you would recall during the discussion of Senate Bill 70, South Dakota has a knack for very long probation terms. And the longer someone's on probation, the more likely they are to have technical violations, which would be things that any other person could do, for example, going to a bar. But because of conditions of probation, that now can create a violation for them. And so the longer that tail is, the more likely. And research also demonstrates that if a person is going to fail on probation, it's likely to happen right out of the gate or within a very short amount of time afterwards. And so this is really intended to sort of peel off those probationers that have showed success and allow us to lower caseloads. And the background is Senate Bill 70 requires the court to adopt rules on earned discharge of at least 15 days for every month. The proposal is 30 days. And these proposals were adopted, recommended by a committee that consisted of judges, defense attorneys, state's attorneys, administrative folks like myself, and chief court service officers and court service officers. So it's something we really took heart at and tried to create a very good working proposal. And the proposals kind of work together. Just to address the comments on the definition of probation violation. So the way this works is, if you're compliant on probation, it's almost going to be a routine that you would be entitled to your earned discharge credit. There has to be something, some event that creates a non-compliance, and that either is going to be through the sanctions grid or it would be the filing of a probation violation report. And so the way it's defined in the proposed rule for the probation violation, that is a court service officer informing the court or a state's attorney that there has been a violation. And once that happens, then that disqualifies the person from getting their earned discharge credit that month. And that's why it's defined that way. It's really the court service officer issuing the probation violation because they're encountering a situation that they think is a violation of the terms and conditions. It's not a judicial finding of the probation violation. It still will go to court for the court to either sustain that petition or not. But the definition really is the court service officer has found a probation violation, and so they're not going to go in and award earned discharge credit for that month.
So it's a definition just for the purpose of earned discharge?
Absolutely.
So can it somehow be limited to that? Because this looks a little bit broader than that. Maybe it is by the way it's going to be positioned, but...
And maybe we can make it clear that that's where it applied. I guess my response would be in the context, this is all we're talking about in this section is earned discharge.
Well, it says that in Section 1. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay. So that sets the limitation of the definition for a probation violation.
The way I would envision it, if it's codified together in the Red Book, it's going to be a section on earned discharge, and so I think we would all know what we were talking about, but I'm certainly willing to make that clear. But that was the intent for for the way it was defined.
I've got another question on another definition, and I guess when you go to the definition of probationer, it's B. B. Section 2B. Okay, about two-thirds of the way down, it refers to a person sentenced to a drug court. Now, I know there's a generic meaning for drug court, but we now have a statutory meaning. Should that be something broader than a drug court? I mean, we got alcohol courts, we got veterans courts, we got the whole program. Is that the right word?
Chief, and the reason that appears in there is Senate Bill 70 specifically excludes drug court participants from earned discharge credit, and that's really because part of that program requires them to be in that program for a certain amount of time, and if earned discharge is rolling their sentence back, it works against the fact that they're in the program and we want to maintain the program. And the court has defined through court rule the definition of drug court to include those alternative specialty courts.
Okay.
So I think that's covered through
this. This is not a generic reference to drug courts, and it's a specific definition that's broader than the word drug.
Yes. It's been written to include, like, our DUI courts, for instance.
Okay.
And then,
I need to cut you off.
And just briefly, current law allows a CSO who believes a person has violated the terms and conditions of probation, failed to comply with the documented directives of the CSO, or to enforce discipline, to incarcerate a person for up to 48 hours. If it's ever going to extend beyond 48 hours, it has to be pursuant to a court order or a warrant issued to require further detention. But that's something that's in 23A, 27, 21, and 21.2. And it's authority the court service officers have had since at least 2005, which is the last time the statute had been amended, and I didn't go back and look any further, but it's something that has existed, the ability to have that 48-hour detention. And maybe I can talk more about that in response to the sanctions grid, but there was some conversation about that statute, so I just wanted to be clear on what it does.
But this would take away the earned, what do you call it, earned?
The earned discharge.
Earned discharge credit.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question becomes, the objection here is based on due process, so the question becomes, are you entitled? Is the credit an entitlement? Or is it a matter of grace, like when we switched from the parole systems? You know, under the old parole system, you had certain due process rights that you didn't have, which you do have. When it's a right, and if it's a right, do they have a valid due process objection here?
Justice, I would say that the way the earned discharge credit is framed, it's something that probationer has to earn. It's not really taken away ever. It's you have to earn it. And looking at other states have structured this, we do build in a component of review there by having a chief court service officer review the denial. And really, that's an administrative review process. That's consistent with how a number of other states have done it. And part of this, and this underlies all the proposals related to Senate Bill 70, is that a sanction and a response are intended to be very swift, very certain, and immediate. And by allowing an appeal each time the person, you know, was non-compliant with the condition of probation, particularly those short of an incarceration. Then we have a court hearing on the fact that the person was late for an appointment and repeatedly fails to get to the appointment. It cuts against the idea, and I think a lot of the intent surrounding Senate Bill 70, to have those swift, certain sanctions. And really, the earned discharge credit, by reducing technical violations, and the sanctions grid, the entire purpose of the sanctioning grid was to reduce formal probation violation hearings before a court, taking up court's time to deal with probationers, and really to vest a CSO with the authority to say, here's the conduct, your conditions of probation are very clear, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, here's the consequence. Very similar to the way our drug court program is set up. I think those are a model for how I would envision these working.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Satizan. Okay, then we would move on to proposal number four, a proposed adoption of a new rule in regards to establishing a graduated response grid. Any opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. Morgan. Charlie McGuigan, I'm the Chief Deputy Attorney General. And one of the concerns that we raised in our letter concerning the grid is we were worried that the grid was replacing the sanctions that 24/7 currently provides. And we were hoping for clarification in the grid to show that 24/7 violations or probation violations would remain two distinct items. In working with Mr. Satizon, he has assured us that our concerns will be addressed and that the 24/7 provisions will stand separate from any probation violations. And I just would like to very much thank Mr. Satizon for working with us not only on our 24/7 concerns, but also on our concerns we had with Proposal 1 on the drug courts. He did provide us with IR 2013-1, and that addressed many of the concerns we had there as well, and I would just like to thank him for that.
Sure. So you really don't have any objections after the visitation with our legal counsel?
Correct, Mr. Chief Justice, and I just didn't really know what hole my peg fit in anymore. So.
Well, you handled it flawlessly by withdrawing your objection, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Justice Inner, do you have a question for Mr. McGuigan?
I was just going to ask you if you had hammered out a response, but I think I understand you to say that you figured out something with Mr. Satizon.
Justice Inner, maybe if Mr. Satizon would like to address that, okay. He has made some assurances to us that satisfy us.
My understanding is it's covered by an IP rule we've already approved.
The drug court our drug court concern is, right. I believe Mr. Satizon plans to address it through the grid, but also through some training on the implementation of the grid.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Any other opponents?
Mr. Chief Justice, other justices, Ryan Kovac here, South Dakota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Regarding the sanctioning grid, our objection mainly becomes when the short 2-day jail term would be imposed as a sanction, as a swift and certain sanction to a probation violation. I did believe that the probation violation definition covered everything rather than just an earned discharge credit. I do believe the due process arguments are much more stronger, I guess, with regards to when a person is losing a liberty interest and can go to jail compared to due process arguments for an earned discharge credit. What we have here, and according to the grid, is that a low-risk offender, our low-risk probationer, that has a moderate offense could go to jail for 2 days. And this is something that is completely, from my understanding of the rules, delegated to the court service officer for their own determination. And there is an appeal to that to the chief court service officer of that district or circuit, and that's where it ends. A judge never finds out about this. A judge never knows if a person gets sentenced to 2 days in jail based on the sanctioning grid.
Do they now under 23A, 27, 21?
Under the current statute? I don't believe they're notified then either. And I do think that an initial hold, they do have the power to hold. And actually, it's Section 5 of the rules states that that would still remain in effect if it's Section 5 of this Rule 4. That states that there's a significant risk to public safety the court service officer can hold. And I believe that's appropriate, that there can be, that should be a hold in appropriate circumstances. But if you're going to impose what's considered a sanction, and the main reason being for clarification to the probation officers and also society. When I did these objections and I proposed the amendments, I did a certain amount of research, but didn't know for sure what to include. In preparation today, I reviewed some case law, and one of them is the Morrissey versus Brewer case, United States Supreme Court. Case site is 408 U.S. 471. The year was 1972. This is the case that requires due process for parole violations and parole revocations, where they set out guidelines to determine that, first of all, that the parole officer themselves should not be the ones that determine the parole violation. You should have a neutral and detached fact finder making that determination. Our probation officers are great. They're trained well. But when you're in the middle of it and you're dealing with a person on a constant basis, you may not be objective. And that's what we're looking for when determining a probation violation. The Supreme Court in that case determined that for somebody on parole, while they're not completely free and they are released pursuant to conditions, and it's a conditional liberty that they have, still going to jail is a grievous loss. So it's a big deal. And as a result, due process was attached. And the reason being, one of the main thoughts is for the fair treatment of individuals with revocations to enhance, and it comes out of page 484 of the case, to enhance the chance of rehabilitation by avoiding reactions to arbitrariness. So it'll actually help, according to the Supreme Court, in this case, the chances of rehabilitation if the probationer themselves does not believe that they are subject to arbitrary decisions. And if the probation officer makes the sanction, and they believe that it's going to be possibly reviewed by a circuit court, it may kind of have an impact on their decision making. I don't believe this will have a major flow of appeals to circuit courts around the state on probation violations, mainly for two reasons. My amendments provide a waiver that the person, if they're notified of their right to a hearing within the circuit court, can waive this. And a lot of the violations are obviously somewhat technical. A lot of them are more clear-cut, like a crime. And I do believe that a lot of people will waive their hearing, especially with a second reason, being that if you do have your hearing and you go in front of the judge and you contest this, that the judge themselves can impose more than 2 days. And the 2 days may seem like, well, I'll handle that, because the judge may impose up to the maximum sentence that's suspended. And the judge could go over the 2 days. So I do believe that we're not going to have a flood of hearings, but just that the due process does require some sort of hearing. It's something where I believe in swift and certain. I think that's appropriate. And I believe, like I said earlier, with the overall purpose and goal, that's why I put in there that the objections had to be done within, I think it was 48 or 72 hours, 3 days. I just, picked a number that they needed to notify that they object to this, and they say that they were not in violation. And they have a right to the hearing, but that I don't believe it's going to be overly used or overly burdensome. Right now, 2 days is considered short. In 10 years, we might come back and change this to a week. And then we might change it to 10 days, and then we might change it to 30 days. This is the point where we need to determine whether or not any time in jail requires due process. And the criminal defense lawyers believe it does.
I guess my concern, counsel, comes from my background, and that's coming from a rural area. And if an officer or court service officer becomes aware of a violation, they usually seem to happen on Saturday night. And your nearest judge may be 100 miles away. Your proposal seemed to maybe be workable in Sioux Falls, but I have some concerns about what you're going to do in a rural area when you can't find that judge. And that's what I assume the 48 hours was for, was then in maintaining that period of time as you try to find yourself a judge.
I understand that concern, and it's legitimate. What I was going to put in the rules but decided not to do was that we could have a means such as telephonic or electronic means, such as how they deal with warrants. And that could be done here, where they could call or email the judge and notify them of what's going on.
That's assuming you find the judge to begin with.
Yes. Yeah, so that's an inherent issue. You bet.
All right. Justice Severson?
Yeah. Mr. Kobach, as I understand your objection or comment, it relates to this being a sanction And that's why the due process, rather than the code section now, which states that court service officer can hold an individual for public safety purposes, but you're now having a court service officer imposing a sanction. Is that what you're...
That is correct.
I'm trying to figure, trying to determine, okay, with that distinction, how would it work here? Or is there a difference since this is a person who is on probation? Have they lost any of their expectation that they, or are they agreed to that with the probation agreement?
I believe, yes, I think my understanding would work that you would agree to this grid section according to being on probation. I think that would be required. And there's a difference, though, with a hold, because if a probation or probationer comes in, for example, to the appointment and they've been drinking, or they had just, there's a new serious charge, that a hold is, that a hold can be appropriate and should be appropriate. However, to determine whether or not there's an actual sanction, specifically with regard to liberty interest being taken away, would require the finding. And especially it relates to the non or the more technical violations, you know, being late or with not submitting AA reports or things such as that nature, which there could be a legitimate defense for, but because that probation officer has dealt with this guy and is kind of tired of it, I'm going to do the sanction real quick and get this person out and impose 2 days, whereas without allowing for the person with the opportunity to present the defense. And that's where, if there's an immediate danger, the hold's appropriate. If there's going to be a sanction, then you need to have the reviewing court review it. And there was also the objection that I put in there regarding shall to may, if there's an arrest, making it discretionary, because the probation officer in this sense may look at the details of the arrest and say, this person's doing very well. He was caught up in a bad situation. I don't want to necessarily do a hold. And I know our court service officers are getting training, and I know that they're going to be using evidence-based practices and doing well, but I don't think there's anything more important in a circumstance where the relationship between the two of them. You know, if the person doesn't want to do the hold, they shouldn't need to if they're otherwise doing well. So there's an objection in there regarding making that discretionary rather than requirement on some crimes. But I hope I answered your question, Justice Everson.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you,
Counsel. Other comments? I guess, Mr. Sazan, I assume you want to speak.
May it please the court. Just very briefly, let me address the Attorney General's comments on the 24/7 program. In reviewing those comments, he's exactly right. We intended the response from a court service officer to a probationer who has a 24/7 violation to be different than whatever the response is by the sheriff or by the court to a 24/7 violation. Really, they kind of run parallel tracks. If someone violates, that CSO needs to respond to that violation, and that response may be, you know, you messed up. This is what the consequence you've already got. Don't do it again. Or it may be, you know, I want to test you more frequently because of the violation. And so I think that the two are intended to work together. And I visited with Judge Long, who I probably referred to as the godfather of the 24/7 program or the father of the 24/7 program. And the way the grid is now, we categorized minor, moderate, or serious 24/7 violations. And he proposed, and I would agree with this and would make the suggestion that we instead go first, second, and then three or more, because then it kind of provides a little bit more certainty to responding to those violations. And it really, the grid was never intended to guide how the sheriff would respond to a person that's in front of them that just had a failed test. It's really meant just for those probationers. And so I think, as the Attorney General and Mr. McGuigan discussed, we talked about this, and that was the intent, and we want to make it very clear. And that's something, I know the court saw the training document that goes along with the response grid, and that's something that we had set out in there. And it's certainly how we want to proceed. And if there's a way we can make that more clear, I'm certainly open to it, because we had not intended to have this go crosswise or to defeat the 24/7 program.
So what happens to a probationer who has a 24/7 violation? That person will be subject to whatever the sheriff normally does, plus whatever the CSO decides is appropriate.
Correct.
So it's stacking, really.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. And then just the Attorney General's office also had made a suggestion about how we define state's attorneys to make it very clear that they're included. I think that's an absolute great addition. It was probably an oversight on my part that it wasn't there, so I would encourage that. And then I think the larger issue is the due process on the 48 hours in jail. Clearly, 48 hours in jail is our top-tier sanction, and we would expect it to be used judiciously by the court service officers. And I do believe, and I think the questioning kind of went down this road, a probationer does have a lowered expectation and a lowered kind of a lowered threshold as far as the review that would be required, I think, for a court service officer to take action against them that a normal citizen would not have. And I think we built those safeguards in addition to the statute that already allows these kind of holds. And the statute's very clear. It is for enforcing discipline. It's also for public safety, but it does relate to someone that violates their conditions of probation. And so the way the rule is structured, accepting the fact that you're going to be subject to this response grid, which, you know, this would go to the probationer. This is going to be a standard condition of probation. Everyone going in knows up front what it is. And it's essentially, you know, I'm agreeing to probation. Probation is a right. This is a condition of my probation, is this the ability for the CSO to respond to my violations. And it also has the... It's not just the court service officer reviewing the jail stay. It's a chief court service officer reviewing it prior to the imposition of the jail sentence. So there is that review. We think that'll be a quick review, something that can happen, you know, in a short amount of time. And when you think about when a CSO is going to detain someone for 48 hours, they probably have them in their office. They may be at their home. They may be at a field visit. But they can't say, I'm going to come back and hold you for 48 hours. They need to have, and I believe that's why the statute exists in its current form, they need the ability to essentially grab a hold of that person and say, you violated, here's the consequence, it's 48 hours. And that's an officer safety reason so that they can, and in listening to our work group when they discuss this, once you start mentioning that jail may be a potential sanction, those individuals start to get very nervous. They want to get out of the office as soon as they can. And if you just said, okay, I want to impose this, but let me check with the judge first, you have to hold them even longer in a less secure setting. And so we did have a discussion about the officer safety reasons and, again, public safety. There's probably a reason that the person has already gotten up to the very top tier of our sanctions. And to impose that, we want to have it happen again swiftly, certainly, and to get their attention right away. That's the entire intent of this. And I would say, in comparing this to other states and visiting with the experts at the Pew Center, our 48 hours is a very short amount of time. I would say most states you would see 7 days to 10 days where the CSO can or the probation officer can institute some kind of a punishment. And I certainly agree, if the grid ever was changed to go longer with the jail stay, we probably need statutory change, and we also would want to build in more due process as the...
Is the reason you went with 2 days because it's consistent with the existing statute?
Absolutely, Justice.
Okay.
What about the Morrissey versus Brewer concern here?
Yeah, and...
What about that?
Yeah, Justice, I reviewed that case, and in my head we respond to all the concerns there by having the fact that the person agrees to this as a condition of their probation. And in the Morrissey case, we're talking about revoking someone from parole. Very different. Obviously, if someone's being revoked from probation, they're going to have a hearing. And I would not equate a probation revocation hearing before the court as requiring the same level of due process as the imposition of a short jail stay under the sanction grid. So I think there is a distinction there.
Well, it's sort of a mini revocation, isn't it? I mean, 2 days in jail does seem like, you know, pretty serious. But you're saying that kind of a mini revocation really doesn't affect the due process concerns that were raised in Morrissey.
Yeah, to me, and as the work group discussed this, it didn't rise to the level, because it doesn't signify the revocation proceeding could signify an end of your probation and now you're going to be sent to the penitentiary. Whereas this really just signifies, you know, you made a mistake, you messed up, I'm trying to get your attention. And that's the entire purpose of having that there. The comment on the felony arrest and the way the rule is structured now, if someone's on probation, they're arrested for a felony, the CSO is required to report that to the court and to the prosecuting state's attorney. You would notice in the Attorney General's comments, they also would like to have that happen for misdemeanor or protection order violations. And we talked a lot about that as far as where the trigger should be. For us, if someone's engaging in felony conduct and they've been arrested, it's probably time to have the court become involved, and that's the reason for the requiring and making that a shall language there. For misdemeanors, current practice now would not say that we would inform a state's attorney of a misdemeanor arrest. And when you think about, we have a number of Class 2 misdemeanors that a CSO may never even know of an arrest for. I would disagree with changing that shall to a may. I don't think it fits the direction of where the rule is going. Those are the comments that I had in response, but I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sazan. Any further comments on proposal number 4? All right. Then we'll go to proposal number 5, and this proposal would amend SDCL 23A354.2. Scratches the word facsimile and changes it to electronic transmission. Any opponents to this? Any proponents? Okay, there being none, that would conclude then the oral hearing portion of our consideration of these rules, and the court will take it under advisement and go from there. We do have an oral argument scheduled in 20 minutes. Since it's on the internet, we will not start till 10 o'clock because that was the posted time. So with that, we are in recess until 10 o'clock.